Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Tom Barbieri. I'm from Call 700 AM, and it's my pleasure to be allowed to moderate this discussion about a topic that I don't think anybody's ever heard of before. It's a secret. The issue, if you haven't heard about it for the past 3 years, is the Main Street Plaza issue. The little bit of Paris. All right, the Main Street Plaza issue. We have all been subjected to, at one time or another, the debates on this ever since it was exposed after they opened the closed doors and the smoke came out of the room and we found out the deal had been done. I don't want that to sound like I'm biased, but I do have an opinion. Anyway, today is going to be a very interesting debate about this subject, and we have some special guests on the panel. We're going to be hearing from Mayor Ross Anderson. Francis told me to say Ross. I want you to know that. Or can I say Rocky's here too, or will I get sued by MGM? I was thinking, by the way, off subject, if your supporters just put a sign of their own on their front yard that said, I'm voting for Rocky II, would that be okay?
There is no trademark issue. It's been badly misreported.
We have Stephen Clark with us, attorney of Salt Lake City, representing the ACLU on this plaza issue, and Reverend Tom Goldsmith, minister first of Unitarian Church, and Tom received his Master's of Divinity from Harvard Divinity School back in 1975. Following the receipt of this degree, he served two Unitarian congregations in the Boston area, was also an opinion editorial writer for the Boston Herald for 3 years, moved to Salt Lake in 1987, and he took over the reins of the First Unitarian Church here in Salt Lake City. And then we have Nancy Saxton, who is a city council member for Salt Lake City. Nancy, welcome. And the issue, of course, and we have representatives from the LDS Church, and they're in here. I understand that the LDS Church has been invited numerous times to participate in this discussion, and this was what I was handed. So the envelope, I feel like I'm on the Academy Awards. I have no idea what's in here. This was handed to me just moments ago. Oh, that. Well, anyway, we now have no disrespect. It's a joke. Please edit that out if you can on the tape. We have this ongoing debate, and I don't know if it will ever end. We've had lawsuits, and it has gone back and forth at 10th Circuit Court. As you know, this all started back in 1999 when Dee Dee Corradini took her tin cup over to the LDS Church and said she needed a whole bunch of money, and they played Let's Make a Deal and sold a piece of Main Street. I know it's a little more complicated than that. The stories go that it goes back into the 60s because the LDS Church at that time, as I've been led to believe or understand, had designs at some point with their future vision of downtown to actually acquire that piece of Main Street and go from Temple Square to Temple Rectangle. And now that they have acquired the crossroads, it'll now be Temple Trapezoid. I've referred to it in the past as the Vaticanization of downtown Salt Lake, but we can understand why and why not. It's a desirable thing for the LDS Church. What they've created is really a beautiful pastoral setting. It is a beautiful addition to downtown Salt Lake. The only problem is they put it in the middle of the street. So the question is, was this a good thing or not? Time will tell, but the debate continues. Lawsuits are still in the works. A new lawsuit has been filed by the ACLU and the Unitarian Church regarding the subject, not so much of Main Street, but the issue of free speech and what constitutes free speech, where the free speech can take place, and the like. So with that said, let's get to the principles in this. And up first, we will be hearing from Mayor Rocky Anderson of Salt Lake City.
Thank you. Thank you. I think in all fairness, since there is litigation and since the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or the Office of the Presiding Bishopric will likely be a party to the litigation at some point, as they were before, they're probably better at following their legal counsel's advice than I am. I've been asked not to say any more than absolutely necessary on the subject, but I don't think that there's anything really new that I'll be saying here today. I don't intend to litigate this matter here today or in the press, but I do think that there are some things that really have been mischaracterized in the media, and it's amazing given all the media treatment of this that there is still so much public confusion about this issue, and that there are still some vast misunderstandings about what has occurred. As you all, I'm sure, know, the initial deal was undertaken by my predecessor, Mayor Corradini, with the, I was going to say blessing, but I guess I hadn't better say that, with the approval and support of the majority of the prior council. It was not unanimous by any means. And then there was a legal challenge, which was pending at the time that I became mayor. When the decision came down from the United States Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit, it was made clear that that decision was based upon the existence of two constitutionally incompatible terms in the original transaction. Two of the very fundamental terms were that on the one hand there would be the retention by Salt Lake City of an easement, which was defined in the special warranty deed as being an easement for access and passage by pedestrians only. It was limited to pedestrians getting onto the block, crossing the block, and moving on. There were specific references to many restrictions that would be allowed in terms of conduct and other expressive activities on the plaza, and a grant to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints of the authority to impose those restrictions. So you had on the one hand the retention by the city of the easement, and on the other hand the ability of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to restrict certain kinds of conduct and expressive activities that I think everybody concedes goes beyond what the First Amendment would allow in most other public forum areas. So we were left with these two promises, and since they were constitutionally incompatible, it fell upon me and our city council to try to sort all of this out. I listened very carefully. There was a lot of public dialogue. I read everything I could get my hands on, both in terms of the legal documents, the case law, all the rest. We conferred with not only lawyers in our city attorney's office, but with constitutional scholars outside. And we developed a proposal, and it's a proposal that I thought held a lot of promise. It wouldn't give everybody 100% of what everybody wanted, but that was impossible since the initial deal had been held to be unconstitutional. In the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, by the way, the court suggested two means of resolving this issue. One was the imposition of time, place, and manner restrictions that would comport with the First Amendment. That is, that the First Amendment doesn't allow everything in terms of conduct and other expressive activities, but you can impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions on those kinds of things. I in fact, was cooperating counsel for the ACLU several years ago in the case involving expressive activities at the University of Utah, where there were protests against apartheid in South Africa, and they brought the shanties onto campus. It was a very important symbolic speech case, and it really came down to what kinds of reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions could be put in place. That was, I think, a huge victory for the First Amendment in the state. So that was one way of dealing with this, suggested by the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. Another way of resolving it that was suggested was for the city to convey the easement so that it would be solely private property. My first proposal was that we define the easement, because it was not defined in the special warranty deed other than as an easement across the property. That was the language that was used. I propose that we say the easement is the eastern sidewalk, about 10% of the property. That way there would be forever a legally enforceable right of pedestrian access across the property, and granting over as its sole property the other 90% of the property to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They could control as they wanted to on that property, conduct and other expressive activities, and the city could impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions on the easement crossing the property. That seemed to me a very good accommodation, a way of preserving mostly the kind of environment that was contemplated, and at the same time preserving that easement for pedestrians in perpetuity. The problem came in that in putting in place time, place, and manner restrictions across the easement, it appeared that there had to be allowed some latitude for disruptions on the property. We proposed that there be gathering places, demonstration places on both sides of the easement, and then across the easement, that groups would not be able to demonstrate there, but people singly would be able to carry signs of a certain size. They'd be able to leaflet, and they'd also be able to engage others in conversation. That initially was supported by the local affiliate of the ACLU. During the public hearings, there were expressions of support, and I don't criticize the fact that they went back and looked at this more carefully before I presented it to the City Council, but on the day that I presented this proposal to the City Council, I received a letter from the ACLU saying to avoid litigation, we had better allow groups of at least five to cross that easement and demonstrate, engage in this kind of conduct. And at that point, especially given what we've seen from the street preachers on that property, that seemed that it would be a real betrayal of what the initial deal was in terms of conveying to the church this property that would be a peaceful and tranquil place. That goes to the heart of what I felt and defined from the very beginning as the fundamental ethical principle that needed to lead us in any of our deliberations on this matter, and that is we have to the extent possible, whether we agree or disagree with the initial deal, and I'm on record from long ago as having disagreed with this initial deal. I thought it was really a recipe for religious divisiveness in our community and actually pretty poor urban planning and traffic planning. But notwithstanding how we felt about the initial deal, when it comes to me, and the city has already made those agreements, I believe the fundamental ethical principle that needed to guide us was that we abide by promises made to the extent possible. I thought that first proposal would go as far as we possibly could in comporting with what the initial deal was and doing it constitutionally. But when it was rejected, it was rejected by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I wasn't hearing much support from city council members. I think that that the first proposal was doomed, and then when I saw that there may be litigation challenges, as there oftentimes are when you put in place time, place, and manner restrictions, I realized that we needed to come up with something else. It's been termed by a lot of people, including the media, as a flip-flop. It's no more of a flip-flop than any time anybody else makes a proposal to get toward a certain goal. That proposal is rejected, and you realize you have to come up with something else if you're going to resolve the situation. That's what I did. Contrary to some of the press representations, nobody suggested to me in any way the second proposal. It's something that I developed and took out to others. I made some calls on December 13th, Friday evening, to see if we could put together some money to build a Unity Center out in the Glendale area, take some property that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had out there, convey the easement, put that matter to rest, and build something that would be of great benefit to thousands of people over many generations. It seemed to me we really needed to get down to that level of what can we do to really improve lives and reach some worthy humanitarian goals. That is the proposal that we made. I've got a brochure here and also an article that was published about this that I authored explaining the whole process. I'd be happy to give that to anybody here and get some extra copies if we don't have enough copies. But I think that this proposal, although it doesn't give 100% to everybody, is the best means now of resolving this proposal, short of that earlier proposal, which was rejected. It was not the result of pressure from anybody. It was not suggested by anybody else, and we saw some great cooperation here in this community with some very generous people, not only being able to get the land to build this community center from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but raising $5 million from the private sector, from individuals, to help make this possible. There have been a lot of charges that somehow First Amendment rights were sold out. I think that if there was any time that First Amendment rights were compromised here, it's when that initial deal transpired where all those restrictions were agreed to, and I have to agree with what Tom said. Those restrictions were not part of the public process until the very last evening that this deal was presented to the City Council and voted upon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor Anderson. Before I introduce our next guest, I just thought of something while we were talking about the street preachers. I never thought I would be able to say this, but I now know what it feels like to be a bride coming out of the temple after a temple wedding ceremony. I was in the Pride Parade, and one of these preachers, and there should be, this whole thing could be solved. You just ban fat guys wearing medium t-shirts with bullhorns. If you did that, we wouldn't even be here today. We were in this parade along with thousands of other, and here there was some of these guys with the bullhorns and the medium black t-shirts yelling where I was going to go, and it was going to be hot, and there'd be no cable, so I know what it feels like now to be harassed by some of these lunatics. Our next speaker, Salt Lake City Council Member Nancy Sexton.
You know, I don't know if I'm surprised that there are so many here or discouraged that there aren't more. I know that this is a very important issue for the citizens of Salt Lake and actually even for the whole region. We've gotten thousands of calls and emails over the course of the months that we've been dealing with the Main Street Plaza issue. And some people feel that it should only be dealt with on a local basis, but I think most of us understand how important Salt Lake City is to everyone who lives in Utah. It's not only important to me as a city council member, but the people that live down in southern Utah and northern Utah really do identify with Salt Lake. And spreading that out even further, because it is the headquarters of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there was interest, of course, from people throughout the United States and sometimes throughout the world. So I think as important as it is for us, there are others who also see it and identify with it and have been interested in it, and some of you may very well be from outside of Salt Lake City. Because it's so important, I know for myself that I took it very seriously, and every comment that I received, whether it be a phone call, an email, people coming after many, many public hearings at the City Council, and yes, even the street preachers, I really did try and sift through and get to the little gems and the pearls of new wisdom and information that I had not thought of and had not been presented to us. And so I took it very seriously. And there were days that I would wake up with one opinion, and the next day I would wake up with a different opinion based on what I had heard the previous evening or had conversations about or from constituents and people interested in this issue. You know, my first occasion, I've been to the Sunstone many times, but my first occasion to speak or be on a panel was entitled Mixed Marriages. And, you know, that's not a surprise. There are many mixed marriages. But in Utah, a mixed marriage happens to be a Mormon that's married to a non-Mormon. And I am the lucky recipient of a better half, actually, that he's here actually tonight or today, and his name is Jan Bartlett, and he is a Presbyterian minister. And I can tell you that it has given me some great insights into how those who are not members of the church or those who are disenfranchised from the LDS church feel and see the strength and the influence, for good or for ill, of the LDS church in our community. And so for me, it's a gift, actually, not only being born and raised Mormon, but also being on the city council and having decisions that include the LDS Church, who have done great things for Salt Lake City, but are definitely a power in our community and in our state. You know, I wasn't on the council in 1999, and I don't know, I must have slept through this debate. I don't sleep through too many of them before I was on the council because I was very active and very participatory in the city and in the community. But this is one of the issues that I heard some things about, but I didn't really get involved. So when I came on the council not long after, we were asked to reconfirm the position and the legal statements for the plaza being sold and all the agreements. I took great pains because I had heard both sides of the argument, had some feelings, didn't really quite know where to put them. So I went back and listened to the tapes, not just the minutes of the meetings of the Planning Commission and the public hearings at the City Council, but also the tapes of the City Council, any discussions that surrounded the Main Street Plaza cell. And I was convinced that within the purview of what the City Council can do, that there were recommendations that were handed down from the Planning Commission that when they came to the City Council on the night of the public hearing and the vote were different. And I want you to know that's not uncommon. It's troublesome for me as a citizen that doesn't necessarily know the channels, know how that information gets passed along, how it basically metamorphoses when we come to a public hearing. But that happens not infrequently for the City Council. So I came to the conclusion that it was not anything that would change the path or the steps that were already being pursued and had already been embarked upon. I really tried to remove myself from the issue of whether or not I agreed with the decision or not, because that was not a question that was posed before me. And you might think, how could I possibly do that? I'll give you some insights into me. The press is very important, but I tend not to read what the press says about me, because I don't want to be influenced. I don't want to start believing the good things that they say that I'm not worthy of. And I don't want to believe the bad things that they say about me that I'm not worthy of. So I tend not to read and keep abreast of what the press says, because I talk to the constituency. I read my materials. I do my homework. And based on those principles and those ideas, that's how I make my decision. So this is no different. When the decision came down from the Tenth Circuit Court, and I, of course, we were kept up with what was happening legally about this particular issue. When the decision came down from the Tenth Circuit Court, I was really taken aback that the administration so quickly came out with a position that the city was going to take the decision of the Tenth Circuit Court as justification to stay what I will call way over to the right, and that is to basically keep possession as a city of the plaza and disregard the improvements that had been put in and the monies that had been put in and the agreement that was originally made between the city and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I was shocked. Shocked because it's a big issue. It's very clear what the city intended, whether I agree with it or not, and what the church agreed to. That's clear to me. It's in the document. The court had a different view of it. So for me, everything became gray. It was no longer black. It was no longer white. It became gray. Was there a motivation for the city and the LDS church to talk, to sit down, to come out to, with a decision that will work for all of us? Absolutely. At that moment, they were motivated because they stood to lose everything. Did we do that? Absolutely not. We didn't do it collectively as a city council. We didn't do it as an administration. We didn't sit down and figure out the points that we agreed to. We took our position and went to a strong all-or-nothing position. That's not the world that I work in. A lot of time went by. We spent lots of time and energy. We had public hearings that I encouraged the council to have. That summit that was on the TVs was my idea because I realized there was so much information out there that was going on behind closed doors that I didn't know about as an elected city council member, and I resented it. And I knew that the public didn't know about it, and you have a right to know because it impacts you as much as it impacts me. So I asked that we get everything out, as much information as we could, so you would know as much as I know. I think it was successful that way. It was at that time, that night, never a minute before, that the administration presented to the city council the option of a time, place, and manner that they had been negotiating without the city council behind closed doors, and they came up with one proposal. One. I was shocked. The area here and the area there, we have this whole space in between, and never was there an open dialogue about it. I can understand why the church did not, the LDS church did not like the presentation that was given to them about time, place, and manner. I can understand that. Does that mean that we have nowhere else to go if we work collectively? I refuse to this day to believe that. It's against everything within the marrow of my bones that I operate under. And that is when you have two willing parties to sit down to an agreement that you cannot come up with an agreement that will work for both parties. That is the reason that when the vote came before the city council, my position was to abstain. It's not that I can't make a decision. It's not that I don't have the strength and the integrity to make a decision. I do. But I do not believe that we had enough information for me to vote whether or not we were then going to go to the other end of the spectrum, and that was to totally disregard the public at large and their rights. I represent everyone. Members of the church, non-members of the church, those who don't believe in a church, those who want to believe in a church. I represent everyone. They have a right to be heard. My position for 16 years that I've been working in the community is not that I have to win, but I'll be doggone, they have to listen to me. I have to have a chance. I don't have to win. I just have to be heard. So for me, and to give a vote of abstaining, is that I can't tell you if I'm willing to vacate the easement. We never worked up to that point. We never worked in the middle where people were motivated to sit down. I understand people have agendas. I hear them every day. They come to public hearings. I try and sift through that. I believe there was a motivation in the administration and with the church that are very clear. And what was left out was the good of the people as a whole. Quite honestly, I'm ready to let this be set aside. Because at this point, there is not the spirit of coming together to find a way to work this out. We've gone past that. Probably about 4 months ago, that's when it was ripe. That was the time to sit down and collectively come to an agreement that would serve both parties. And both parties are the city and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I talked to very few people that did not have the integrity to see the problems that total free speech brought to the plaza. Most of the people understood that it was uncomfortable for the LDS Church and the problems that it brought to them. And they felt that we need to find a way to come to a middle ground. I believe that the ACLU is a great representative to all of us. Anytime someone perpetrates a lawsuit or projects an opinion that is contrary and goes to the very core of our belief, which is generally religion and a spiritual belief, then it becomes very scary. The question is not the problem. What do we do as a society with a question that we could be on either side of? Don't be scared. Be productive. Believe that we can come on the other side is better than where we are now. Allow us to work through the process. As I've said, do you believe in the Constitution? We benefit from it. We revel in it. We die for it. Do you believe in it? This is the best of our Constitution, is for people to ask questions and challenge the decisions that have been made by the people that you elect. I'm looking forward to your questions.
We have to get her out of her shell. Thank you, Nancy.
Did I go over time? I'm sorry.
We're enraptured with your presentation. Our next presenter, speaker, is Reverend Tom Goldsmith, First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City. Reverend.
Well, it's a joy to be with you this morning, right here in this hotel. I'm so glad for the opportunity to share a wider perspective regarding the Main Street Plaza controversy. I hope that in our brief time together we can move closer to understanding the rationale of why a church such as the Unitarian Universalist Church would ever opt to become involved in litigation against the city and even risk the perception of contributing further to the divisiveness that plagues Salt Lake. Contrary to all the media reporting, conflict is not the favorite pastime at the First Unitarian Church. But we may play into Lenny Bruce's indictment of liberals when he said that liberals can understand everything except those who don't understand liberals. It's my hope that we can further the understanding of one another. I'll tell you one thing I find fascinating about Unitarianism in Utah. There are barely enough Unitarians in the whole state to fill but two Mormon wards. And yet, somehow, we have become a household name synonymous with either divisiveness or courage, depending not so much on your religion or politics, but on how you view how the Bill of Rights pertains to life in a city dominated by one religious culture. For some, free speech is a right. For others, it's a nuisance. Free speech has never come without controversy. The Federalists opposed the Bill of Rights on the grounds that it was unnecessary. The LDS Church might be inclined to agree. But the First Unitarian Church feels it's the mainstay of our democratic tradition. The Bill of Rights, inspired by Thomas Jefferson and drafted by James Madison, endorsed the will of the American people, who wanted, strongly wanted, guarantees that no government would trample upon their newly won freedoms of speech, press, and religion. Democracy and liberty are often thought to be the same thing, but they are not. Democracy means that people have the right to vote for public officials in fair elections and make most political decisions by majority rule. Liberty, on the other hand, means that even in democracy, individuals have rights that no majority should be able to take away. Liberty means responsibility to a minority, which is why any majority, in this case, the dominant religion, dreads the exercise of liberty because it threatens to diminish their power and influence. Jefferson and Madison knew from the very beginnings of our new nation that protecting the rights of individuals expressing a minority view would need the judicial system to protect them. A system of individual courts were devised to act as arbiters of how the Constitution should be applied. The courts would be, and I quote Madison, the courts would be an impenetrable bulwark of liberty. The Unitarian Church signed on as plaintiffs in 1999 in the first Main Street lawsuit against the city because the wall separating church and state had become a sponge. Religious influence on secular affairs had grown intolerable. The sale of Main Street, with a blind eye cast on the retainment of a public easement, proved one more example of an egregious misuse of power. Civil liberties were threatened in this, our community. And the courts agreed. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, in a blistering 39-page decision, and in all respect to our mayor, I went through this decision line by line with the ACLU. We did not see a menu of options. You could do this, you can do that. It was a blistering 39-page decision that declared that the easement on Main Street was a public forum and that free speech applied there. And then on June 23rd of this year, the United States Supreme Court let that decision stand. But now, look what's happening. Now we're facing the city's attempt to bypass the highest court in the land. Free speech was traded away for land on the city's west side. And Rocky, whom I support unequivocally, in spite of his Main Street shortcomings. In fact, I would give him a B-plus or an A-minus in his mayoral report card. I love the man. But a few, you know, blind spots. Rocky justified this land deal under the banner of restoring peace. It was a very tempting proposition. I mean, ask yourself, who would not relish an end to the painful strife that tore our citizens apart, mainly along the religious divide? But aren't we really facing a conditional peace? Aren't we giving up the fundamental American right to free speech? The point is that as a city, we must learn to manage our differences, not pretend there's no conflict. Whenever a community is engaged in movement towards change, it ruffles the establishment sensibilities. This is true in politics. It's even true in the art world. It's true in religion. You name it. Whenever there's a push to move forward, to progress, to open the windows and allow a little fresh air and new light to come in, the seat of power naturally becomes upset because it clings to business as usual. But don't you think it's time for us to move on? And that's why the Unitarians signed on as plaintiffs once again. It's time for Utah to move on from its romanticized pioneer past to the fresh reality of Utah in the 21st century. We are blessed with a rich diversity here, a diversity of people and cultures and ideas. It's time to move on where we conduct secular business in this town with or without the blessings of the dominant church. It's time to move on where bringing Utah into mainstream American life is not confused with Mormon persecution. Nobody is being persecuted. We're just trying to follow the dictates of the Constitution and obey the courts of the land. One thing I want to make absolutely crystal clear today. Unitarians and the street preachers who infiltrate the Main Street Plaza, are light years apart in religion, politics, and civility. We have absolutely nothing to do with those who spew ugly hatred in the name of Jesus. And furthermore, the Unitarians who have been in this valley since 1891 have never, once, and still today, have any desire to protest the Mormon faith. But freedom of speech...
Thank you, Reverend Goldsmith. Before I bring up our final speaker, I thought about First Amendment. Being a broadcaster, newspaper columnist, author, and public speaker, talking about freedom of speech being not for sale. For $8 million, you could have my microphone, my book, my column. Never mind. And the shirt, yes, the shirt. Our final speaker this afternoon is Stephen Clark, attorney for the ACLU.
thank you, Tom, and thank all of you for coming and for allowing me to share some thoughts today. I don't know what I did to deserve following two very capable and passionate and committed public servants and an obviously eloquent and passionate preacher. I'm actually very grateful that they continued to agree to show up to this some months ago when it was organized. I agreed because I'm no longer with the ACLU. I'm a private citizen now with some knowledge of these events, but I thought, well, this will be a nice chance for me to be able to be out from under the yoke of being a lawyer in a case and just talk with some liberty about some of these issues. I think probably the mayor and the city councilwoman and even the reverend probably envisioned more of a sort of a kumbaya moment up here where we'd be all hugging and singing, if not kumbaya, maybe we thank the old God for a prophet. instead, here we sit, not celebrating an end of the divisiveness in our community, but struggling to understand what it means and how we might be able to deal with it. So let me say at the beginning that unlike my fellow panelists, I'm in the pro-divisiveness party. I don't think the divisiveness in this instance is a bad thing. And I think actually the continuing litigation, the continuing discussion of these important matters offers all of us a chance to grapple, as Reverend Goldsmith suggested, with the reality that we live in. And that's nothing to be afraid of. Historian, University of Utah historian John McCormick has called Salt Lake City a contested site. And I think if you reflect on the history of this city, you will agree with him that its history has always been characterized by such questions as, whose city is this? Who belongs here and who doesn't? Whose voice will be heard and whose will be silenced? For many of us, the sale of a central block of Main Street in the heart of downtown Salt Lake City, and along with it, a delegation of the power to police that block of Main Street to the LDS Church, provided quite a powerful demonstrative answer to those kinds of questions. And the answer that it provided was that the one that you read from time to time in letters to the editor in our city, we were here first, and if you don't like it, you're welcome to leave kind of mentality. Those of us who perceived that sale and that delegation in that fashion could certainly have avoided divisiveness and contentiousness by simply acquiescing and saying, you know what, you're right, you're in the majority, we'll go about our business. But sometimes, as the Reverend so eloquently stated, commitment to principle requires not shrinking from battle, but joining battle. And so the battle was joined, and the battle continues. I want to emphasize that from the perspective of someone who was on the front lines of that battle for a long time, and I'm sure I speak for Reverend Goldsmith in this respect as well, the battle is indeed about principle and not about personalities or parties. An editorial in the Deseret News last December tried to paint quite a different picture. It said, there's only one reason the ACLU and its minions have pursued this issue and turned it into a Mormon haters cause celeb, and that's because it is an opportunity to irritate, to embarrass, to yap and nip at the heels of the LDS Church. That accusation is totally false. The truth is that the ACLU and all of those directly involved in legal challenges to the Main Street Plaza controversy share with the LDS Church, and I'm sure with all of you here, a strong commitment to religious liberty, and indeed support and defend the church's rights to share its message, not only its religious message, but its views on a range of social and political issues. So if not anti-Mormon bias, what exactly is it that inspires this ongoing battle, and why should any of us care about it? Well, the first, in my view, is rooted in the law. We are a society governed by the rule of law. We all respect the law, and the law does have an impact on our relations in this community. As the mayor, I think, fairly summarized the original deal, the Tenth Circuit found that there were irreconcilable goals that were expressed. One was for the city to obtain an important public objective of retaining Main Street in its historical capacity as a central downtown pedestrian public thoroughfare. The other was for the LDS Church to achieve, from its perspective, an entirely understandable goal of prohibiting unwanted speech critical of the church. Now, those two things clearly were ruled to be incompatible. But there was a third provision that the mayor used to talk about. He's stopped talking about it for obvious reasons. The third provision of that original agreement was that in the event a court found those two key terms to be irreconcilable, the church would back off. The church would say, city, you can keep the easement and it will be governed by constitutional standards. We accept the risk, essentially, going into this deal that a court may rule that you can't have your cake and eat it too. Now, what happened, though, immediately after the decision came down? Did the church say, you know what, we assumed the risk, we anticipated from the beginning that these two competing goals would be irreconcilable. We will abide by the agreement we signed, and we will support the city's efforts to enact constitutional regulations on this property. That's not what happened. The very day, the very week the decision came down, the church immediately began its pressing demand that the city abandon the easement, that the city relinquish what the city had consistently described from the beginning of the transaction as the critical element from the city's perspective. Mayor Anderson, to his credit, came up with a proposal that would have given the church 95% of what it originally bargained for, while leaving the city with only 5% of what it originally bargained for. That struck me as an individual, and I think it struck the ACLU as a very generous offer and as one that certainly pushed the limits of what is constitutionally permissible. But in the interest of compromise, in the interest of achieving peace not through capitulation but through genuine compromise, we were willing to take a look at that. What did we hear from the other side? Absolutely not. Nothing less than 100% of what we want will do. Now, folks, when you're in that kind of a negotiation, there's not much room for compromise. There's not much room for anything but pressing forward with other kinds of considerations. So legal principle is what underlies the continuing lawsuit. But I want to suggest there's also a spiritual element, maybe one that many of you can identify with. This organization, from time to time, I'm sure, has been accused of being anti-Mormon, and I doubt that most of you sitting here feel as though you deserve that kind of label. You do seek alternative ways to understand your lives, your relationships with God, your families, and the world we live in, but that doesn't set you up necessarily in opposition to the Mormon Church. It's the same way those of us on the other side of the Main Street Plaza feel. Main Street, after all, is not just so much real estate. Poems from the sentimental, Joyce Kilmer's Main Street, to the sublime, Walt Whitman's Song of the Open Road, have always celebrated what this country's public spaces represent. To paraphrase Whitman, they express us better than we can express ourselves. In an age of ubiquitous cell phones and virtual communities separated by electronic gulfs, it strikes me as ever more important that the perhaps quaint idea of the public square be even more vigorously protected. Indeed, the Tenth Circuit said, as society becomes more insular in character, it becomes essential to protect public places where traditional modes of speech and forms of expression can take place. We think this is particularly true with respect to downtown public spaces conducive to expressive activities. Now we're at the point where the Mormon Church will be able to bring exactly the same kinds of arguments it has brought to bear in pummeling the city into submission and releasing the easement to a broader swath of downtown where the church's investments are growing, where the church's influence is spreading, the Crossroads Mall, the ZCMI Center Mall. What will our downtown look like? Whose city will this be? Who will decide whose voice will be heard and whose will not? I'm afraid that based on the precedents the city has created, the answer to that increasingly will be the Mormon Church's and no one else's. Thank you.
That concludes our panel, and I want to thank you all for attending. If I may say something on behalf of just ordinary guy, I'm not an attorney, I'm just a citizen of this valley. Been here 32 years. When I moved to Salt Lake in 1971, I didn't know anything about Salt Lake, about Utah, or about the LDS Church. And 32 years later, I still don't know much about Salt Lake, about Utah, or the LDS Church. All kidding aside, I'm sorry to see this divisiveness to continue, because what the Main Street issue to me has shown is that the veneer of tolerance in this community is extremely thin, and it's sad. I find it very sad. So I hope that this can be resolved and people can learn and work to get along better and accept the differences and celebrate the differences and enjoy that. Thank you all for attending this afternoon. Yeah, what? We have 5 more minutes? We have 25 more? Oh. Okay, it all started in a small 500-watt station in Fresno, California. Oh, that's not my time. They never did tell me where the clock was. So it's time now, before I ramble on incessantly, for your questions to the panel, I assume. Is that the format, Don? Okay. I'm sorry? Form a line? We can point you out. You know, this isn't... Okay, all right. That works.
So they have to come to this
I missed the final rehearsal for this, as you can tell, ladies and gentlemen.
So this is the microphone they need to speak into.
Which microphone would that be?
I think it's that one there on your left.
This one here?
Yes.
All right. Come on up and trip over the cord and sue the hotel.
Rocky, I agree with everything you said. You're a statesman. You did a great compromise. I wish my relatives in Bountiful and Kaysville didn't think you were such an extremist on the legacy project. But my question and comments to everybody, but particularly the former ACLU attorney, and this is apples and oranges. I don't mean to compare this, you know, in an exact analogy is a bad idea. But 20 years ago in Skokie, Illinois, there was the ACLU involved in the Nazis outside the synagogues there, one particular synagogue, where former survivors of the Holocaust met every week. And the minister had to come, and they had to have a pig outside with a yarmulke on it. They were throwing bacon at him and all this. And the compromise was to move this 2 miles away to a park where they wouldn't have to be subject to this every week. And the ACLU opposed that compromise. I think we need free speech for the Nazis or whoever, but you don't have to do it in people's faces like that. I think it leads to divisiveness, and people's rights need to be respected and protected, even absurd speech, like these people that are yelling in the bullhorns, everybody's going to hell and everybody's a queer and whatnot. But I just think we need to have a compromise and time and place times to demonstrate. I wonder your opinions on that.
I agree. That's what time, place, manner is all about. And that was agree. And as you point out, the ACLU was at the forefront of defending the most vile and hateful speech against unwarranted, heavy-handed governmental regulation in that case. And the principle was exactly the same. The speech was taking place, yes, in the proximity of what the local Jews considered a holy site. But it was in what's called a traditional public forum. Therefore, it couldn't be banished from that site. It could be regulated as to time, place, and manner, which is exactly what we proposed transpire on the Main Street Plaza. No, I mean the most offensive speech, unfortunately, the most effective speech sometimes is the most offensive speech. And the courts have long held that people need to have meaningful access to their target audience in order to be able to make their points. And when it comes to a sidewalk or a street, which are the traditional public forums, that's pretty much open, subject only to a permit requirement or something like that that's administered on an even-handed basis.
Thank you. Rocky would like to address the question, I believe.
In this instance, I think the opportunities for First Amendment expression are still essentially available to all. There are sidewalks on both North Temple and South Temple at the end, at both ends of what we suggested would be the easement area on both ends of the plaza, where everybody has full First Amendment rights to expression. And I think that nobody's First Amendment rights are in any way significantly compromised by conveying this easement over the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they're getting what everybody anticipated they would get, and that is a peaceful, tranquil place without these disruptions, without street preachers creating the kind of disruptions that they've done there. We, in putting together the time, place, and manner proposal, we thought we had gone about as constitutionally far as we could in proposing restrictions, but we were told, and this did, in all fairness, come after my second proposal, but I urged the City Council to still consider the first proposal, time, place, and manner proposal. But when we got a letter from the ACLU saying to avoid litigation, you'd better allow groups of at least five to demonstrate across the entire plaza, that coincidentally enough was the same day. Nobody could have scripted this any worse for the ACLU's position. That was the same day that there were five street preachers down there screaming down a wedding party, refusing to move so they could have their photograph taken with the temple in the background. And at that point, I said, we cannot, in good conscience, go back on what the prior administration had promised, notwithstanding my adamant disagreement with what that initial transaction was.
I just had a question. You mentioned that you went line by line down the Tenth Circuit's ruling. I never read that, but I did read in the paper just a summary. I wanted you to maybe clarify, because my understanding was that the Tenth Circuit ruled not really on the issue at hand, but the fact that since there is an easement there, it has to be a free speech easement. And the way to solve the problem is not to have an easement there anymore. And that was my understanding, that's sort of what the plan is. And I would like you just to maybe comment on that or address that issue.
Yeah, I don't want to get too legalistic about this. There is a line in the Tenth Circuit's decision that lawyers refer to as dictum that essentially says the city can't have its cake and eat it too if it wants free speech on the plaza. If it wants the easement, it has to allow free speech. If it doesn't want free speech, it can't have the easement. There was in no sense an authorization or a ruling on whether the city could solve the fundamental constitutional problem by conveying the easement. And the problem with what the city and the church have agreed to now is that for all practical purposes, the functional equivalent of an easement, a public sidewalk, remains on the plaza, and there's no intent to change that. It will continue to serve this important public function of a public thoroughfare. And the ACLU's position is that so long as that factual reality remains on the ground, then the legalities of who holds title and what rights are assigned sort of artificially don't matter, that it's the reality on the ground that controls. That's an important issue that, frankly, the Supreme Court hasn't dealt with for some number of years, but it's happening all over the country as cities essentially try to privatize what have long been public sidewalks and thereby distance themselves from their constitutional responsibility to regulate the sidewalks. I mean, just to put it in concrete terms, what if Salt Lake City, facing a budgetary crisis, decided to auction off all its public sidewalks to the adjacent landowner, and along with it, the ability for that landowner to police the sidewalks? There would be nothing left of our public forum doctrine, and this is what the courts are now grappling with. If we create this precedent where property continues to serve as the functional equivalent of the town square, but is given over to private parties who can discriminate based on race, based on religion, based on anything else, what is left of this concept of the public forum? That's really the issue.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I have the same question you have, and I think the question is, in that ruling from 10th Circuit, line by line, did they suggest these are what things that you could do to solve it, which is give it up, sell it, or trade it?
No.
They did not make suggestions for that in the ruling?
No.
Okay, is that what...
Nor would that be an appropriate thing for that court to do.
Because the implication in the papers, as I read like you did, implied that the 10th Circuit gave these options as a solution. And that's not...
The one thing the court did say very clearly is that the public's rights cannot be bartered away even for money.
Okay, the way it was couched in the papers, they gave suggestions on how to solve it.
That's because that's how the church presented it and the politicians have spun it.
If I may, as I said, I'm not going to litigate this here, and these are legal arguments. All I would say is I absolutely disagree with that. You need to look at the language, and as Stephen said, it's dicta, but it's there. There is a suggestion by the court that there are two means of resolving this dispute, and you answer it for yourself just by looking at the opinion, but I think to get in these sort of legal arguments isn't very productive here today.
How do we get our hands on a copy of that? It's on the ACLU's website.
I'd like to ask Rocky to define the manner and time that's in this proposal. How bad can they be, mannerism, and how? What's the time? Also, the Unitarian man. I've never heard of this going to the Supreme Court of the United States. I thought it only went to the Circuit Court.
Yeah. To answer that last question, there was a petition for certiorari to the United States Supreme Court, and that was denied. So, the final decision in that case. We'd like to call it the final one, but in that first case, the final decision is that of the United States Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. In terms of the first proposal, and it's laid out in the brochure that we've handed out, and I'm sorry we didn't bring enough copies. We can get more copies for you. It's also on the Salt Lake City's website, which is slcgov.com. But just very briefly, what that proposal entailed, I think the primary part of that, although everybody refers to it as a time, place, and manner proposal, the primary part, I think, of that proposal was defining where the easement would be, and that is the sidewalk on the eastern side of the plaza, so there would be access for pedestrians back and forth, and that was clearly the intent of the easement under the special warranty deed. It wasn't an easement for people to gather there and protest and do all the rest. What we suggested as to the restrictions was that there would be gathering areas on both ends of the plaza, and then as you went across the plaza, you couldn't go in groups to protest. You could carry signs only up to a certain size that we suggested. You could leaflet. You can't prohibit that under the Constitution. And we felt that there was, in fact, Mr. Clark, before I came up with the proposal, had said, and it was quoted in the newspaper, saying that he felt that we could put something together where we didn't allow any demonstrations across the plaza. But we thought that was really pushing it in terms of First Amendment analysis. We wanted to make sure that we were safe. But then, just before I presented this to the City Council, I received another letter from the ACLU that said, contrary to their earlier support for the proposal, that if we wanted to avoid litigation, we'd need to allow at least five people to together demonstrate across the entire plaza. And that just simply was so far beyond anything that was contemplated by anybody, this initial transaction, that wouldn't be allowed. Also, in terms of time, place, and manner restrictions, it's important to understand, any time you put in place time, place, and manner restrictions, it's always subject to some legal challenge. Somebody can always sue saying, well, you restrict it to five, why not seven? What about this distance? What about these times during the day? What about these decibels? I mean, there are so many kinds of challenges that could be made. It looked like we're going to be involved in litigation forever if we relied upon time, place, and manner restrictions. I wish we could have done that. I think it would have been a good resolution for everybody. But I also think the second proposal is going to bring a lot of good to this community. And the one thing that kept echoing in my head was Tom Goldsmith's statement in the public hearing that was televised, that if we can't figure out how to resolve this, how do we expect peace in Jerusalem? And it seems to me there needs to be accommodation. There needs to be some compromise. Standing for principle is really important, especially when it comes to our Bill of Rights, but also bringing some peace and doing some good for a lot of people, as this Unity Center will do, I think is also important. And we tried to resolve this the best we could. We went through 8.5 months of community dialogue, open houses, interminable open houses, even the point where only 12 people were showing up, and most of them had already been heard a number of times. I think the community had its say on this. All but one member of our city council voted in favor of it. And I think, frankly, no matter where people stood on this, they were tired of the divisions in this community. And once we get beyond this, people are going to look back in 5 years and say, with all the abilities to exercise First Amendment rights on the sidewalk, what was this really all about? I think it was about much more and much different kinds of things than the First Amendment and this plaza.
You know, it's not easy for me to be silent, but I just want to give a tidbit. If you believe that we have more information and more knowledge as your elected officials than you do, that's why you don't attend the meetings. I want you to attend the meetings. I want you to get involved, because we don't. That our decisions are based on the information that we have. The fact that people don't turn out to meetings doesn't mean that's a good sign.
My question is directed to Mayor Anderson, who unfortunately seems to be fleeing the scene. My question is this. The claim that the church agreed in the original contract to back out if the deal proved unconstitutional makes a huge difference in how I perceive this issue, and it seems to make a big difference in the argument that the ACLU is planning to make. So I was wondering if perhaps you also, from your perspective as a lawyer, would care to comment on that claim.
Yeah, I commented on it a lot, as maybe a lot of you noticed, and I think I had a lot of people very angry at me at the time. But looking at this, not just as a lawyer, but I think any layperson could look at this clause. It's called the severability clause. And it does provide expressly that if any part of the special warranty deed were held to be unconstitutional, the rest would remain in place. And that's exactly the situation we were facing. So it's a matter of, do we stand on the legal terms of the agreement, or do we take into account what everybody intended would happen if these restrictions were declared unconstitutional? Frankly, I think what happened here was there was over-lawyering on the city's part by the city attorney. I think he put in all these protections just in case something happened, thinking we could negotiate it from there. Stuart Reed even said that it was the city's intention, notwithstanding what was in the written document, that if the restrictions were declared unconstitutional, the easement would just be turned over to the church. Now, I think if that was the intention, it should have been spelled out in those documents and disclosed to the public. But we heard from everybody during the course of this, everybody that was involved, including my predecessor, that the intention was what the intention was with regard to the nature of this place. And I think that, yeah, we could have said the severability clause provides this, and the legal analysis is that it's just wide open in terms of First Amendment expression on that property. But I think the right thing in the end was to recognize what everybody intended and to preserve the kind of environment on that plaza that everybody on both sides initially intended. And again, I wasn't around at the time, but we certainly heard from everybody in Technicolor what those intentions were, and it was clearly that this be a place where the sorts of disruptions and demonstrations would not be permitted. I'm going to have to go. I'm sorry if anybody has another question. I've got an address at the University of Utah in about 10 minutes. Thank you all very much.
Come back, Shane. Come back. I don't know if you're able to answer the question because it was going to be addressed to the illustrious mayor. It concerns what appear to be kind of a quid pro situation with the Sorenson Recreation Center down there. Having grown up in the Salt Lake area and then leaving the state for 20 years and returning, I had worked for three different state legislatures, and so I understand the problems of working behind closed doors. But I've also been the executive director of nonprofit organizations. And what was troubling to me was to look like there had been something tossed out that was like crumbs to the west side of town, and that it really hadn't been prioritized anywhere. And that was very distasteful to me. 20 years ago, we had to get a little aggressive with the UTA bus lines to get lifts on the buses for the handicapped. And that's because I literally had people that were dying that couldn't get to their location on kidney dialysis. And so all of a sudden, we have people that are able to put money in for a priority, I suppose, on the west side of town, but I have no idea what competition took place to get at that level with all these other competing nonprofits. And that just gets very distasteful of how we're letting a gorilla kind of run things on the priorities.
I don't presume to answer for the mayor, but I can tell you the information that I had. This was a unilateral decision on the part of the mayor specifically to get money, the amount of money that was asked, the property that was asked for by the mayor of the LDS Church was, as the mayor mentioned tonight or today, was his idea. I can tell you the city council had absolutely no input. It was done behind closed doors. It was done with an elite few that these discussions and the maneuvering took place. And that is still doesn't taste good to me. And I think that there is no doubt in my mind that the Sorenson Center is a great asset to the community that it serves. But there is no mistaking in my mind that this does not serve all of the citizens of Salt Lake that are injured, are inconvenienced and are disenfranchised. So for that reason, I also believe that there should have been a more open discussion if there was going to be an exchange of money. My personal belief is that if the easement vacating was the right thing to do, then it should have been a nominal fee, it should have been a formality, and it should not have been anything that looked like an agenda or blackmail or a political maneuver. If it's right, it's right. It shouldn't cost anything. That's my own bias. So you can take it from there.